From NHPR, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. The state is resuming the use of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine at a time when more than a third of the state's population is now fully vaccinated. We'll check in on the state's efforts to vaccinate Granite Staters, including those who have been disproportionately impacted by COVID. Also, as President Biden rolls out his plans to invest in the nation's infrastructure, we'll take stock of efforts already underway to expand broadband here in New Hampshire. These and other stories made headlines this week, and we're so glad you're here to talk about them with us today. If you've got questions about COVID-19, now's the time to call. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also use Facebook, tweet us, or email us. Our email address is exchange@nhpr.org. With us for this part of the program, Ali Pham, NHPR's health and equity reporter, and Casey McDermott, NHPR's investigative data reporter. Welcome to both of you.
Good morning, Peter.
Thanks for having us.
So we're going to start today by talking about the latest information about the coronavirus in New Hampshire, talk about some new data on how well our state is vaccinating its vulnerable populations as well. Ali, what is the latest with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine? What's the status of that? It was canceled for a little while, but it's back now.
Right. Yeah. So there was a federally recommended pause on the vaccine, and that ended last week. So here in New Hampshire, the vaccine's kind of been, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, that is, has been kind of slowly coming back online. This weekend on Sunday, the state has 3 sites that are offering the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. And I spoke to some hospitals and some pharmacies a little earlier in the week, and, you know, they were ready to administer it, but a lot of them actually didn't have that much on hand. And, you know, Governor Sununu said yesterday that the state is only going to be getting around 2,200 doses this week. So, I mean, it's back, but it's still a minority of the vaccine that we've got here in New Hampshire.
So with limited doses, does that follow that there's limited opportunity for people to choose that vaccine if that's the one they want?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this weekend there's those 3 clinics, and as of yesterday, there were still spaces open. So it does seem like people are going to have the opportunity to some extent to choose it if it's the one they want. And this, and a spokesperson for the state said earlier this week that they are working on a new feature for appointment booking, so that if you're booking your vaccine online on Vinny, will know if you're booking a Johnson & Johnson appointment.
I see. Okay. Overall, Ali, how is the state doing when it comes to vaccinating its residents?
Yeah, so I think numbers-wise right now, we're doing quite well. The state announced yesterday at a press conference that it had administered more than 1 million doses of the vaccine, and that around 33% or so of residents were fully vaccinated. However, they also said that new signups are really slowing down, and we're not actually at a place where we're, you know, at herd immunity. So I think that slowdown is concerning.
And yesterday at the press conference, it seemed like Governor Sununu was open to the idea of people from other states, particularly neighboring states who do business in New Hampshire, coming on into New Hampshire if they're having trouble getting vaccines in their own states.
Yeah, absolutely. He definitely kind of made a specific call out to folks who might be working in the state or shopping in the state to, you know, also, I guess, take their business to the vaccine sites as well and get a shot here in New Hampshire.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about another number, and that's the number of cases, new cases of COVID-19. What's the status there? Are we seeing a rise, a fall? Is it about the same?
Yeah, so we are trending in a good direction when it comes to new cases of COVID-19. On average, the daily new cases have been falling for just over 2 weeks, and our test positivity rate has fallen as well. Community transmission is still substantial, though, and, you know, it is with school vacation, that trend could reverse itself with people traveling or just hanging out more with friends and family.
Mm-hmm. Earlier this week, Allie, the CDC released new guidelines about mask wearing, including recommendations for people who are vaccinated. The CDC said if you are vaccinated, in most cases, if you're in a crowded, unless you're in a crowded area, outside is okay without a mask. How does this fit within our state's current policies?
Yeah, so I think the CDC guidance is still a bit stricter, honestly, because our statewide mask mandate is gone. And, you know, I think once May 7th really rolls around, we'll also actually start to see less mask rules indoors. And that is not something that the CDC has recommended.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about what changes are coming for May 7th.
Right. So on May 7th, all of these COVID-19 safety restrictions that have existed are going to switch to recommendations and essentially become a sort of best practices as opposed to something that you've got to do. So, you know, what that means is, you know, a restaurant doesn't need to space tables apart, or, you know, there's not going to be social distancing required at facilities like arts venues or amusement parks. And instead, the state is kind of letting businesses decide what steps they want to take to protect their staff and customers against COVID-19. So, you know, businesses can say, you know, everyone has to wear a mask in our facility if they choose, but, you know, they're not going to have to do that.
Well, listeners, we'd love to hear your thoughts on this. What do you think about the easing of restrictions that's coming as of May 7th? Let us know your thoughts, how it might impact your business or the way you do business out in the community. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. You can also email exchange@nhpr.org. And also in a little while, we're going to be talking about vaccine access and equity. If you have not been vaccinated yet but would like to be, are there any challenges you're running into? If so, let us know what they are. Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Ali Pham, you recently reported on the state's ID requirements for vaccinations. It's a little complicated, so I'm hoping you can run through the details with us. What is the ID requirement for vaccines in New Hampshire?
Right. So the state has an FAQ page on their website, and they say that you need proof of identity when you go get a vaccine here. And that can include a valid unexpired driver's license. It can be a non-driver ID card, or it can be a passport. And there's a little bit of flexibility with 16 and 17 year olds, where their parents can actually be the person helping out if those 16 and 17 year olds maybe just have a birth certificate. So, you know, the state online does say that you're going to need an ID to show your identity.
Okay. And are there places you can go where if you just don't have an ID, you can still get a vaccine?
Right. Yeah. So there are. The state has said that you can call them. So you can call 211 if you don't have an ID, and you can request a waiver. You know, that was information that was hard for me to find. I couldn't find information about the waiver on their website. I also found, you know, if I talked to a spokesperson at Rite Aid, and they are getting vaccines through a federal program as opposed to the state. And Rite Aid says, if you don't have an ID, it's okay. We're not turning anyone away. So you can, you know, book an appointment at Rite Aid. And then the state also has equity clinics through the regional public health networks. And a lot of those are really aimed at vulnerable populations, and they often do not need ID.
Let's go to the phones and talk to Pat in Belmont. Pat, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Good morning. How's it going?
Good. What's on your mind?
I think it's time to reopen. I work as a service tech in restaurants, and I think they're all really hurting. I think all the numbers have kind of come down quite a bit, and I think it's time to get some stuff reopened. And I mean, if it's the restaurant's prerogative to have people wear masks, then, you know, wear them. But I totally support just, you know, getting stuff reopened and, you know,
mm-hmm.
The numbers have drastically fallen. Vaccines have been up. Everything's been going good there. So, you know, I think it's time to really start trying to come back to normal.
Well, Pat, thanks for your insight and your voice of support for lifting the restrictions as of May 7th. Vaccines, as Pat mentioned, are becoming more widespread. And Casey McDermott, I want to turn to you. The state set a goal of using 10% of its vaccine doses to reach vulnerable populations, specifically racial and ethnic minorities, people experiencing homelessness, and those with other barriers to access of the vaccines, such as homebound people. So you've been digging into the data on this about how it's going. So tell us, has the state been reaching its goal on this?
So no, the state is falling short. The data that we have is a few weeks out of date, but what we know is that, as you said, the state aimed to use 10% of its COVID vaccine at the state level. So this doesn't include, for example, like federal allocations that the state got or that are coming into New Hampshire for nursing homes, for example. But according to data provided to NHPR through an open records request, 21,801 doses were used at equity-focused clinics between February and early April. You know, that was out of, you know, the state set aside about 55,000 equity doses, but did not use that full 55,000 that were set aside. So that 21,000 number only accounts for about 3.8% of the, you know, of the state level vaccine supply. So that's falling a little bit short of that 10% goal that the state set so far.
And Casey, do we know why the state hasn't distributed all of the 55,000 doses?
So I think there are a few levels to this. First, it's important to note that the state has really placed a lot of the responsibility for running the equity clinics on regional public health networks. So these are more kind of at the local level. They're the ones that are partnering with organizations in the community, identifying spaces for clinics, bringing clinics of you know, all different sizes, sometimes very small sized clinics, to, for example, low-income senior housing facilities or shelters for people experiencing homelessness, things of that nature. State officials have said that, you know, they say that they knew all along that this was going to be a difficult, you know, that this was going to be a challenge because, you know, by just a lot of the people that they're trying to reach are those who already, you know, may have barriers to interacting with the health system or, you know, other services in their community. So they say that, you know, it's going to take a little bit longer to reach all of those people. However, the state did say that they're doing, you know, they're making some additional pushes on a few fronts to reach out to more people who might benefit from the equity-focused vaccine clinics. That includes a push to partner with more companies across the state that employ frontline or low-wage workers, and also companies that employ people of color. So the state is, you know, identifying lists of companies that may be a good fit for this, but they also said that people are welcome to reach out if, you know, they work at a company or if they run a company that may benefit from bringing vaccine clinics directly to work sites so that, you know, they eliminate the barrier of having to take time off or having to travel to get the vaccine.
So we may start seeing more clinics pop up at places that employ a lot of essential frontline workers.
Yes. Yeah, that's the goal.
So overall, Casey, where has the state been successful in reaching people who have been disproportionately impacted by COVID or maybe are experiencing homelessness?
So that question is a little bit harder to answer based on the data that we have right now. I can tell you that there have been, you know, a range of clinics held at, for example, like I said, low-income senior housing facilities. There have been clinics that have been targeting multiple vulnerable populations. So that could include racial and ethnic minorities, people experiencing homelessness. That also includes people, for example, who are experiencing substance misuse disorder or people at domestic violence shelters. So it's targeting a range of people. I think that one thing that we've heard over and over again, both from state officials, but also from the people that are running the clinics on the ground is that the places that this has been most successful is where, you know, there have been established, like really focused on establishing like partnerships between health officials and, for example, like a faith community or, you know, someone who is a leader within a particular immigrant community in a region of the state. Because then there's someone who is already, you know, who other people in the community may have an established relationship with. They may be able to look to that person and trust that what they're telling them is, you know, trustworthy. So that makes it easier then to coordinate the clinics and also to have someone who can provide answers to questions that people might have about the vaccine.
Well, listeners, if you have questions about vaccine allocation, now is a great time to give us a call to ask that question. Our number 1-800-892-6477. You can also email exchange at nhpr.org, but getting on the phone is faster. Again, the number 800-892-6477. Casey, you mentioned the vaccine clinics and public health networks. I want to turn that question to Ali Pham as well, because you've been doing some reporting on this. Ali, what else is going on here beyond what the state is saying? What have you heard from public health networks that are in charge of setting up vaccine clinics?
Yeah, I think, you know, to echo what Casey was saying, that a lot of these really successful ones are clinics where they're partnering with an organization or even a community member that people already know. And I think, you know, they've also driven home that these clinics are very small. Some of the ones that I've been to have maybe, you know, only distributed 30 doses of the vaccine. So, you know, it's not surprising that the numbers here are so small.
Mm-hmm. We get this question from Anne. Anne asks, according to the new guidelines, is a wedding in a large tent with 200 guests allowed? All guests will be required to be vaccinated. So that's the question from Anne. Ali, I don't know if you know the answer to that, but the new guidelines replace the former industry-specific requirements and they're universal. So Ali, does the state currently have restrictions on event sizes, either indoor or outdoor?
Ooh, you know, I'm actually not totally sure what the restrictions are at the moment on that. But, you know, once May 7th rolls around and things become best practices, I think, you know, it's really going to depend on, you know, what venue that person chooses and what the restrictions or not are there.
Well, is there the state would list all the state's guidelines specifically at the state's website. Is that true?
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay, they'll have those guidelines on the universal best practices document.
I'd be curious to ask Anne how she would enforce that among her guests. I mean, that's a personal decision, of course, if you require your guests to be vaccinated. But are you asking guests to show their vaccine cards at the door? I'm not sure. But Anne, good luck with your wedding. We hope it goes well for you and everybody stays safe. Casey, has the state announced any other efforts to increase vaccine access for Granite Staters?
Yeah. So there are a few others in addition to focusing really on, you know, like I said, like frontline workers, it are, you know, additional clinics partnered with faith communities. You know, this is something that's been going on throughout, but I think that the state sees that as another opportunity to really meet people where they are. And again, you know, kind of leverage existing like community ties and community connections across the state to improve vaccine access. The other one that is worth noting is the state is looking to add more clinics at food distribution sites and food pantries. So these are like, you know, hot meal distribution sites in addition to food pantries. They say that they've done this a little bit already, but they're really looking to expand it and bring it, you know, even to maybe some smaller food pantries across the state. And one of the things that the state said there was, you know, again, this is a place where someone may already, you know, have a routine of going to a location to meet another need, and in this case, food, and they can meet this other need, which is vaccines, while they're there at the same time.
Let's go to the phones and talk to Barbara in New London. Barbara, thank you very much for calling. What's your question or comment?
Okay. I think one of the reasons for some of the hesitation on the parts of some of us is the failure to have the vaccine available locally. Now it suddenly is starting to come, which is kind of late in the game. I was waiting. Now, this is a personal thing on my part. I refuse to drive 30 to 50 or 60 miles to get a vaccine as a one-way trip and then back again. And I did finally get a local appointment. When I called at the beginning of April, I have an appointment for the end of May, just before Memorial Day. But I think that is one of the hesitancy problems, not necessarily fear of the vaccine, but the refusal to jump through 85 hoops.
Well, Barbara, thank you very much for the perspective, and I'll put that to our guests here. Allie, have you heard other people express sentiments similar to what Barbara just expressed, that they'd like to get the vaccine, but they don't want to drive an hour one way and then an hour back just to get it?
Yeah, absolutely. Transportation is definitely one of the challenges that folks have been facing when it comes to getting a vaccine. And, I think one of the regions of the country we've really seen that crop up is in the North Country, where, it's really rural. And one of the things I know they've been at least trying to do is offer people the ability to get picked up and driven to the vaccine. But, that's something that takes a lot of logistics and coordination. So, yeah.
We get this note from Maria, who says, "Hi, I have a 12-year-old, and I am hopeful that by the time we plan to travel mid-August, that they will have been able to get the vaccine." So vaccinating people under the age of 16, still not possible at this point, Allie, right?
Correct.
Is the federal government giving any updates on testing and when it might be available for people under the age of 16, or is that beyond the scope of this conversation?
Yeah, no, I think Governor Sununu actually mentioned yesterday in the press conference that they are expecting at least those in the 12 to 15 age group to be cleared to get the vaccine fairly soon, and that, that may, again, it may happen in the next month or so, but, it also might not. And, again, that's just the 12 to 15 age group.
All right. One change worth noting that Governor Sununu spoke about at the press conference yesterday, which is that soon those who have been collecting unemployment benefits during the pandemic will have to resume searching for work to continue qualifying. That had been suspended during the pandemic. What's behind this change? Maybe go to you, Casey.
Well, I think the governor said that, like, at this point, the state is really, there's a lot of jobs available, that the state is in a position to encourage people to search for work. Also, because the vaccine is more widely available, I think there's perhaps some rationale there that may eliminate, in some ways, some concerns that people may have about putting themselves back into the workforce or back at risk. I think that, we'll see how that works out in the coming weeks, because there's certainly a lot of people who have been taking advantage of, and I don't mean that in a negative way, but who have been, staying at home or doing that out of concerns of their own safety. So we'll definitely keep an eye on that in the weeks ahead.
Thank you for that, Casey. And Allie Pham, before we let you go, let us know what you will be following as you continue your reporting on COVID-19.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for asking, Peter. So one thing I'm looking at right now, and we'll be into next week, is just kind of talking to some nursing homes and long-term care facilities. I think they're in this very kind of difficult position right now, where a lot of their residents and staff are vaccinated, but we haven't, we're still far from reaching herd immunity elsewhere in the state. So things are not really back to normal in those facilities. So I'm just kind of trying to talk to folks and hear what, a return to normalcy is looking like and what it might look like down the road.
Well, Allie Pham, NHPR's health and equity reporter, thank you so much for sharing your insights with us today. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Peter.
NHPR's Casey McDermott's going to stick with us, because after a quick break, we're going to talk with her about oversight of county jails. New Hampshire is something of an outlier when it comes to oversight of these jails. Oversight is put primarily in the hands of local elected officials, people who, generally speaking, have no formal correctional training and no supervision from state officials with relevant expertise. So your comments or questions on this are welcome. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also email us. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. Back in a minute. You're listening to the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you so much for tuning in. When it comes to keeping watch over New Hampshire's county jails and how they're protecting the people who live and work inside, most of the responsibility falls to county commissioners. Elected officials, often with no formal correctional training and no supervision from state officials with relevant expertise. NHPR's Casey McDermott has been reporting on this, and we'll speak about it with her, and you are invited to join the conversation. Do you have experience with county jails and how they're overseen? We'd love to hear your story. Give us a call now, 1-800-892-6477. You can also email us at exchange@nhpr.org. So Casey McDermott, what led you to look into this story about oversight of county jails?
Yeah, so I think a few things. First of all, you know, as we've seen during the pandemic, and I think particularly in kind of around the winter surge a few months ago, there were a lot of cases in county jails across New Hampshire. More than 460 coronavirus cases have been reported at county correctional facilities since the start of the pandemic. That's according to state health data. And that also includes people who both live there and the people who work there. Valley Street Jail in Hillsborough County in Manchester has experienced two outbreaks totaling nearly 200 cases. So that puts them at having about 40% of all of the county jail outbreaks in New Hampshire. So one of the things that we wanted to look at was who's in charge, who is responsible for making sure that those facilities, which really hold, you know, highly vulnerable, at-risk people, who's in charge there? And one of the things that we saw, particularly around the time that that outbreak was starting at the Valley Street Jail, was, you know, the state was, you know, kind of initially when asked questions about it, said, you know, that's kind of out of our control. Same thing kind of at the city level. And what we saw was that it's actually county commissioners, as you said. So the people who are kind of not quite at the local level, not quite at the state level, but in between, who are really the kind of caretakers of correctional facilities at the county level in New Hampshire. You know, this is just kind of a you know, an aside. I got interested in this actually while I was working on other reporting, and I, you know, was looking at the Attorney General's website as I sometimes do, and stumbled upon a page on there that listed a bunch of county correctional facility inspection reports. So if you're out there right now and you're curious about how your county commissioners are overseeing the correctional facility, this is one way that you can assess that. You can look at these inspections. And I saw some things in those inspections that raised some questions in my mind about how county commissioners were carrying out their oversight responsibilities. So that, coupled with the pandemic, were really the impetus for this.
Well, we'll get to those things that raise concerns for you. But give us a perspective from the perspective of the county commissioner. Well, like, what do they normally do as part of their county commissioner duties? And where does this oversight fit in? I mean, how often are they checking in, and what are they looking at when they are looking at county jails?
Yeah, so there's really a lot of flexibility given to county commissioners in terms of how they exercise their oversight responsibilities. What I heard from county commissioners that I spoke with, or who, you know, otherwise provided comment for this story, is that, you know, they're required to do these twice a year inspections where they visit the facility, they you know, assess the management, condition, and security of, you know, the facility, and then they're supposed to write these reports on their actions or proposed actions based on what they see inside. In addition to that, However, you know, county commissioners meet regularly, and often at their regular meetings, the jail superintendent will provide an update on, you know, how many people are incarcerated at the facility. You know, maybe other relevant information about the status of the jail at that point in time. And the commissioners said that they, you know, they take their role seriously. They really try to ask questions. They try to make sure that they're, you know, monitoring what's going on there, both in those public meetings and also in private meetings and private communications, or, you know, more kind of one-on-one communication between themselves and the jail officials. However, they also said that they don't really have any, you know, supervision in this. They don't have any formal training. There's no statewide standards for jails in New Hampshire. So it's really it really varies widely from county to county in terms of the kind of philosophy that county officials bring to, you know, how they run their correctional facility, and also, you know, how they carry out their, you know, holding those facilities accountable. It's also worth noting that New Hampshire seems to be in the minority in terms of how it approaches this. I spoke to an expert who, you know, has really devoted her career to studying prison and jail oversight across the country. And she told me that 28 other states provide at least some kind of jail oversight through, you know, a state correctional agency, sheriff's association, maybe an independent commission, or in some cases, the state health agency. But she said, and again, this is someone who studies this, you know, wasn't aware of any other state except for New Hampshire where the primary responsibility for monitoring county jails rested with local elected officials.
So the county commissioners, they get regular updates from people who administer the jails. They get written reports. And it's in these written reports that you saw things that raised alarms for you. What did you see in those reports that said, hey, this might not be right? It might not be as thorough as it could be. What did you see?
Yeah, so I think, you know, there were a few things that raised questions for me in the reports. One was just that the majority of the reports were rather brief. Like, it was rare to see reports that were more than, you know, one page, or if they had more than one page, the additional pages were like a checklist with like not a lot of comments on there or a lot of depth that would allow the public or anyone reading the reports to really, you know, understand what's happening inside the facility or what the commissioners actually saw. You know, in other cases, I think notably in Hillsborough County, so for Valley Street Jail and then Stratford County, the commissioners seem to write essentially the same report over and over and over again. So what I'm talking about there is that, you know, over a period of time for which, you know, reports are publicly available, this is dating back to like 2013 to now, so like 8 years, the commissioners wrote essentially the same thing in all of their reports. And, you know, I'm looking at like some excerpts from Hillsborough County. So this is the same jail that had the big outbreaks of COVID. The same jail has, you know, been rather troubled in terms of its management over the years. It's faced a number of lawsuits, had a number of other public incidents there. The commissioners, however, whenever they visit, they write, you know, the inmates are being cared for pursuant to, and then they cite a state law, and are appropriately supervised by trained correctional staff. They say, you know, as of this writing, there are no specific actions that need to be taken. And that was something that was repeated over and over and over again, essentially verbatim. Same with Stratford County. It was different, you know, different words than what Hillsborough County used, but they said the same thing over and over again. So what that said to me was that, you know, are you really giving this a thorough examination? Are you really making note of, you know, changing conditions inside the jail or actions that you think need to be taken to ensure that the jail is running smoothly?
And is there any indication that these reports were not accurately describing the situation on the ground?
Well, there is in the case of Hillsborough County, and the reason I say that is because, you know, one of the reports, one of the jail inspections that was conducted by a county commissioner, you know, was conducted according to the report on December 28th. That was, you know, at the end of last year. It was around the time that questions were being raised about COVID protocols at that facility. And just a few days after that visit, a Hillsborough County Superior Court judge you know, said that he was deeply troubled by the cavalier attitude that the facility was showing toward its, you know, the people inside during the pandemic. And that stood in sharp contrast, that judge's ruling, from, you know, what the commissioner said, which is that, you know, they found the condition of the facility, the security of the inmates and the management to be in order. So there was kind of a split screen, like really different view between those two officials about what was happening inside.
So what changes have occurred since you've started asking questions, or what changes are likely to occur about with respect to oversight of these county jails?
Well, I mean, that's really up to county officials. I will say that, you know, one county that we talked to, Grafton County, said that they planned to change how they approach their reports after being contacted by us for this story. In the past, Grafton County's inspection reports were actually like authored by jail officials. So these are the same people that are supposed to be the subject of the reports, were the ones, you know, signing off on them. The Grafton County Commissioner who I spoke with said that, you know, that will not happen any longer, and that also their inspections were much more thorough than what the reports reflected. So they're going to make a change to make the inspections more detailed to reflect, you know, the conversations and the attention to detail that they try to bring to those inspections. And I should say too, you know, one kind of notable exception that I saw when I was reading through these reports was Cheshire County. The commissioners there historically have provided kind of a minute-by-minute log of their visits. So saying, you know, at 11:30 a.m., we toured this part of the facility. At 12 p.m., we spoke to this person who's incarcerated, or we spoke to this correctional officer. And the reports also include, you know, summaries of basically what are characterized as kind of private conversations between the commissioners and people who live and work at the jail. Not all of those conversations are positive, but I think that it was, you know, that stood in sharp contrast, the kind of feedback that came across in their reports from the very high level, generic, everything's fine here, that was on display in a lot of the other counties.
So Cheshire County, in some ways, setting a standard of transparency that other county jails haven't yet met?
Well, I'm not the one who sets the standard, but okay. They definitely were being more transparent than other counties, or at least seemed to be.
Well, listeners, if you're interested in reading more about Casey's reporting, you can find it at nhpr.org. And before we let you go, Casey, I want to switch gears and check in with you on another story. And that's the ongoing saga around SB3, the bill that added steps to New Hampshire's voter registration process several years ago, including asking people to prove they live where they're trying to vote. It's faced court challenges for years. Casey, can you tell us a little bit about the latest step in the court saga?
Yeah, so as you said, this is an ongoing saga. This was a 2017 law, and it's basically been tied up in court pretty much since it passed. It was, you know, passed along sharp party lines. It was a Republican-backed change that, you know, it's rather detailed, so I won't get into it here, but just basically added steps to the voter registration process and also added additional penalties that have not been in place, but, you know, that changed, you know, the penalty for not providing the right kind of information when you're registering to vote. So it's been tied up in court for a while. A lower court judge deemed it unconstitutional. However, the state appealed that ruling, and it's now before the state Supreme Court. That's where it was earlier this week. What we heard in that court was, you know, a lot of the same arguments that we've heard, or that I've heard and others who've been following this, you know, in previous hearings, which is that, you know, on one side, we have the New Hampshire Democratic Party, the League of Women Voters, and their counsel saying that this is complex, confusing, burdensome, and really not justified to meet, you know, any kind of state goals. On the other side, however, we have state attorneys saying that, you know, in their view, they acknowledge and have acknowledged over and over again that voter fraud is not a problem or not a substantial problem in New Hampshire. However, they say that this law is justified to improve voter confidence and to prevent any possible wrongful voting. And they also have said that, according to them, the mechanisms in the law will just make it easier for state officials to, you know, review the paperwork that people submit when they're voting. We've also heard on the other side, though, like lots of local officials who say that this makes their job harder. So it kind of depends on who you talk to. But right now it's in the state Supreme Court's court.
Well, NHPR's Casey McDermott, thank you very much for bringing us up to speed on these stories. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And coming up after a break, can't talk about infrastructure without talking about broadband internet. Money from the COVID-19 relief package is meant to improve access to high-speed internet. We're going to take a look at efforts to distribute that money and connect more Granite Staters. And we want to know your experience with getting access to high-speed internet. Was it a requirement for you maybe before moving to New Hampshire? And if so, did it help you decide where to move in New Hampshire? Certain spots don't have it. Other spots do. What about virtual learning? Has it helped or hindered your ability to get broadband in your city or town? Let us know about broadband in your region. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. For many families, the COVID-19 pandemic underscored the need for reliable high-speed internet. Kids going to school remotely, workers needing to switch from in-person to Zoom meetings, patients connecting with doctors via telehealth, all depended on a fast, strong connection. But in New Hampshire, some areas still lag behind the rest of the state in broadband connectivity. With us now is Amanda Gokey, energy and environment reporter for the New Hampshire Bulletin, who's been writing about this. Amanda, welcome.
Hi, Peter. Thanks so much for having me.
Glad to have you on the roundup. And listeners, if you've got a story about how the lack of broadband in your town has impacted your life, let us know. We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Maybe you've tried and failed to get better service where you are. Again, 1-800-892-6477. You can also email us, exchange at nhpr.org. Amanda, what have you found out about the nature of the problem of uneven broadband access in New Hampshire?
Yeah, absolutely. So what I've learned is that there are certain parts of the state, primarily in rural areas, where this is a bigger problem. It tends to lag in the northern and western parts of the state, although there's also cities that are affected as well, including addresses in places like Keene. I spoke with Senator Bradley about a town in that he represents.
Senator Sandwich. Jed Bradley up in Wolfboro.
Yes. And he was saying the town of Sandwich has virtually no broadband. But there's also a lot that we don't know about exactly where in the state this is a problem. And right now, the state is relying on internet providers to give data about exactly which addresses lack broadband that's up to the federal definition for speeds.
And the federal government has allocated $50 million to broadband development in New Hampshire. It did last year. How was that money used?
Yeah, so that was one of the issues that did come up in this reporting. While there was $50 million set aside to go towards building out broadband infrastructure, only $14 million was actually able to be spent. This was with the last stimulus payment, and there was a deadline to spend that money by the end of the year. But because the broadband build out requires a lot of intensive planning, a lot of communities simply weren't at the point where they could actually make use of those funds.
I imagine that was frustrating both for lawmakers in New Hampshire and residents who were hoping to get broadband put in as soon as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the things that current legislation is trying to help smooth over for future funding, with the expectation of significant money coming from the federal government in the latest stimulus funding, as well as Biden's infrastructure plan, which specifically calls out broadband and building out broadband infrastructure. What they're trying to do now is to set up a state program so that funding can get out the door more smoothly.
Oh, and how would it work? What are some of the details of this legislation that would maybe hopefully expand broadband in New Hampshire?
So what this proposal does is it creates a match grant system, and currently the language in the bill would allow for 50% of a project, a qualifying project, to be funded through that money. So the money could go to an internet provider, a current provider. It could also go to a town that wanted to do a project on its own, or it could go to a communication district. And only projects that are reaching underserved or completely unserved addresses would qualify for this money.
So some grant money going to the places that really need it most. You reported, Amanda Gokey, in the New Hampshire Bulletin on two very different strategies for towns that towns use to build broadband. One is kind of known informally as the Chesterfield model. Can you explain what that looked like?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Chesterfield model is something that's been around. It's been allowed through legislation starting in 2018. And essentially what it does is it allows towns to take out a bond for funds that will allow them to pay for these broadband buildouts. And there's about 18 towns that have started this process. Six towns currently are offering service through these efforts. And really what happens is the town is raising money and then they're working with a provider in their community to help bring down that total cost of the project. Because really the issue in rural areas has to do with the density of houses. So for a provider going in to build out very expensive infrastructure, they look at how many houses are on a particular mile of road, for example. And I've heard the number in Vermont of about 20 houses being this sort of cutoff for when a provider will look at a project that can be profitable for them. And so that's why we have the problem where there are these gaps in coverage, especially in rural areas where that number of houses may be much, much lower. And so through bonding, towns are able to get providers to build out these services.
And the town of Bristol used a different strategy. What did the town of Bristol do?
Yeah, so the town of Bristol took a different approach, and they actually started working on this in 2017 before bonding was an option that was available to them. But I talked to their town administrator, Nick Coates, and what he was saying is that he felt it was really important for the town to retain some control over this infrastructure. If they were going to be putting in a significant investment of the town, he wanted the town to be able to have more leverage and control in these conversations with the providers. So they actually raised money through grants. They applied for several different grants, and they were also able to raise some town monies for that as well. And through that sort of fundraising effort, they have built out what Nick Coates refers to as a backbone. And it's essentially a segment of infrastructure. And then from there, it kind of achieves that same end goal where, because providers can link up with that backbone, their total cost for a project would be significantly reduced. But in that model, the town does get to retain control and ownership of some of the infrastructure, as opposed to paying a price for something that they wouldn't have that same control over.
Well, Amanda, this is a story that has been going on for years and years. As you continue reporting on this, what will you be looking for?
I'm definitely curious to see how this approach pans out. One of the concerns that I think a lot of people have right now is, you know, it can be really difficult for a town to take on this type of project. It requires a lot of expertise. They're very complicated projects. They're very expensive projects. And I think the approach has really been what we've seen as sort of a patchwork. And so there's been really no language about a universal mandate. So I'm going to be interested in seeing which towns are able to take advantage of this, and, you know, always curious to see and hoping that there aren't places that are falling through the cracks without additional technical assistance, and just to see whether this money is really reaching the communities that are in pretty dire need for these services.
Well, Amanda, before we let you go, I do want to shift gears and talk about another story you've been reporting on, and that's the story about low carbon fuel standards. In 2019, Governor Sununu said the state would not join the Transportation and Climate Initiative, a regional effort to reduce carbon emissions. But now the Senate is considering legislation that would prohibit state employees from exploring low carbon fuel standards programs. So first of all, what was this Transportation and Climate Initiative, and why did the governor not want to just join in the first place?
Yeah, the Transportation and Climate Initiative is basically a regional cap and trade initiative. It aims to improve transportation, develop the clean energy economy, and to reduce emissions from transportation. So it's really looking at clean vehicles and fuels and improving transportation. It was started in 2018 and it's run out of the Georgetown Climate Center. I think a lot of the concern about joining this program has to do with increasing the cost of gasoline. And I think there's been a lot of hesitancy to do that. And I think it also certainly depends on, you know, what a particular governor's policy priorities are.
Mm-hmm. So this proposal about prohibiting state employees from exploring low carbon fuel standards program, where did this come from?
So it was introduced by Representative Jeanine Nodder, and she, in her testimony on the topic, said that in looking at the Department of Environmental Services, that they had spent 800 hours of time speaking about this initiative, which amounted to about $50,000 in their time. Just to be clear, it wasn't that they were paying that money to anyone. That was sort of her accounting of the time spent basically discussing this. And while New Hampshire has not joined this program, this state officials are staying up to date on what's happening in the region with the program. And so Representative Nodder said that for a program that New Hampshire isn't going to join, this would be a good way to save money. And there was also discussion about sending an additional message in terms of the state's energy policy.
Mm-hmm. But the bill says it wants to ban discussion of all low carbon fuel programs, not just the Transportation and Climate Initiative. So that sounds like it might extend beyond just this initiative and limit discussion of similar programs.
That's correct. And that was a concern that was brought up in this hearing as well. And I think it's a concern in terms of both the letter and the spirit of this. If it does become law, while the conversation has really been focused on the Transportation and Climate Initiative, the actual language of the bill doesn't call out that specific program at all. So I think that there are concerns with how this would be interpreted and implemented in practice.
Mm-hmm. Really quickly, Amanda Gokey, before we let you go, I wanted to end the show on a lighter note. You've been reporting on a piece of legislation related to selling mushrooms in New Hampshire. Can you tell us a little bit about that really quickly?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a proposal to essentially establish a license for people who are foraging wild mushrooms. And those who are supporting it include foragers themselves, restaurant owners, and it's really, they're billing it really as something that's about food safety. And it's also a method for them to be able to continue selling wild mushrooms because federal regulations require there to be essentially some sort of regulatory authority around the sale of mushrooms. And currently New Hampshire doesn't have something like that in place, which has kind of left foragers in a legal gray zone when it comes to selling wild mushrooms that they have foraged.
So now they might have to get a license before they go forage?
That's right. There's a license. In the proposal right now, it looks like it would cost about $30 and last for 5 years. It includes two different tiers of mushrooms. So my understanding is that, you know, one of those tiers is sort of the easier to identify and less potential for a mix up with a toxic mushroom. And then a second tier that would require a bit more knowledge and have potentially higher consequences if a forager were to make a mistake.
Huh. Well, I'm particularly interested in this because wild mushrooms are among my favorite things to pick up at the farmer's market. I haven't taken the step of looking for them myself in the woods, but I appreciate those who do. And I appreciate you, Amanda Gokey, for being on the program today. Thank you very much for sharing your insight with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Amanda Gokey, energy and environment reporter for the New Hampshire Bulletin. And this has been the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Remember, you can find links to all the stories we discussed today at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Today's show was produced by senior producer Christina Phillips. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our executive producer is Michael Brindley. Jessica Hunt and Jane Vaughn produced the show. And our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.